This is KLLG LP 97.9 FM, Willits, California. I'm Greg Schindel, train singer, and we are now boarding the Bipolar Express. All aboard!
Chugga, 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 chugga up the hill. Puffing and a chugging, you know that engine will reach the summit and go down the other side. Whoopee! What a ride! Clickety clackety, clickety clackety click. Look at the engine, that's old 45. Fired up and ready, she seems to come alive. Listen to that wailing whistle all around the countryside. Whoopee! What a ride!
Whoopee! I love that. Whoopee! Hey, whoopee and hello to Little Lake Valley and beyond. Hey, today we will complete our story of Black Bart, Boulevardier Bandit. And it's part of our, you know, our local outlaw history. So, you know, what makes Black Bart stand out from all the others? For one thing, he committed 28, I'm talking about not two or three, 28 stage robberies for over a 5 to 8 year period. Now, he was a regular serial stage robber, I'd say. And, you know, his method or pattern during holdups was so consistent that, as one lawman said, he might as well have signed his name. Hey, I'm Greg Schindel, train singer, and we are on the BPE on KLLG 97.9 FM up here in Willits, talking about one of our local bad boys. So today, we will pick up where we left off last week when Black Bart, he had just finished robbing the Little Lake Ukiah stage. That's just outside of Willits. And successfully, he broke open the iron box that Wells Fargo had put on board this time. We did it with a hammer. So I want to say that if you'd like to hear all three of the Black Bart bipolar shows, they are 93, 94, and 95. And you can access that on www.bigfig.net/BP Express, www.bigfig.net/BP Express for the whole story of Black Bart. Okay, here we go now. Now, exactly where Black Bart spent the next 30 days after this robbery, well, it's not known, but early in July, it found him in Plumas County involved in his 24th stage robbery. Now, as between robberies in the fall of the previous year, it is unlikely he would have returned to San Francisco for such a relatively short period of time, and it's doubtful that he would have changed moving into some small mountain or foothill community where, as a stranger, he would have stood out. Now, on rare occasions, he accepted shelter for the night or two in remote homesteads, but since the weather would be mild in the summer, he probably camped in some isolated area, probably not far from where he planned his next holdup. Perhaps he had a camping outfit and food cached somewhere in the mountains. Now, the privation experienced in the field during his army years, that may have prepared Bart for the rigors of existing in the mountains with little or more or nothing while on his stage robbery campaigns. Now, apparently he lived on the little he carried with him, mostly dry food that could be eaten without cooking. And there are few, if any, authenticated reports of him visiting stores or trading posts to replenish supplies during his early robbery years. And in rare instances, Bart stopped at isolated ranches or cabins where he was invited to a meal, and on occasion stayed overnight, as he did at Billy Foster's cabin during a storm. Now, at times, Either before or immediately after a robbery, Bart hiked cross-country 40 or 50 miles through mountainous terrain in a single day. Only those who have traveled trailers backcountry can appreciate what a feat of endurance that really is. And if Black Bart can be given credit for nothing else, he at least proved himself a superb woodsman and survivor. Yes, he did. Well, on the morning of July 13th, 1882, 9 miles from Strawberry, the familiar flower sack masked figure stepped into the path of the Port Orville stage, which was carrying $23,000 in gold. Oh, my goodness. Ignoring the armed guard riding beside driver George Helm, the bandit pointed a shotgun squarely at Helm and politely instructed him to throw down the box. The flower sack hooded man standing there in the road was just too inciting a target for messenger George Hackett to resist. As the bandit brandished his shotgun in front of the lead horses and waited for Helm to throw down the heavy box, Hackett raised his rifle and fired. At best, it was a snap shot, for Hackett had to raise his rifle and fire in one almost instantaneous movement before the bandit could pull the trigger of his shotgun. Adding to Hackett's problem, the stage robber's body was shielded by the horses, and Hackett had to hold his sights high on the man's flour sack-covered head in order to avoid hitting the animals. Well, at the report of the rifle, the bandit, without returning fire, whirled and disappeared into the trees that screened the road's edge. Hackett jumped from the stage and gave chase. But he was unable to run down the robber. But a short distance from the road, he found the flour sack mask and a blood-stained, bullet-punctured hat. Oh, my. For the remainder of his life, C.E. Bowles, alias Charles Bolton, alias Black Bart, bore a narrow scar along the top of his right temple. Woo! Close. Now, since this man, known as Black Bart, was no stranger to gunfire, having spent 4 years in combat in America's bloodiest war, it's quite probable that he did not return Hackett's fire because, as he later contended, he never carried a loaded shotgun in any of his 28 robberies. Wow! Well, it was for a little more of a month or two after his narrow escape in the LaPorte Orville stage robbery attempt, Black Bart laid low. How he explained to friends his newly acquired scalp wound is not known. Quite possibly he attributed it to some mining accident. Certainly few of his San Francisco associates would ever connect this well-mannered man of apparent means with such a thing as crime or a bullet wound. Hey, not long deterred by his close brush with the death, on September 17th, Bart stopped the Wairika Redding stage 14 miles out of Redding, and for the second time in 2 years, encountered stage driver Horace Williams. The reunion did not exactly fill Williams with delight, but he was traveling without a messenger, that means a shotgun guard, and there was nothing he could do but turn over the express box and mail sack to the shotgun-toting bandit. Black Bart's last robbery of 1882 occurred November 23rd on the Lakeport Cloverdale Run. He ordered driver Dick Crawford and several passengers off the stage, then forced them to unhook the horses and lead them up the road. Waiting until they were out of sight, he pried open the metal express box and rifled the mail. Now, it's not clear how much Bart realized from either the September or the November robberies, but probably it was not a great deal. You know, the glory days were over in the mining areas, and in areas such as Lakeport and Cloverdale, which were outside the gold country, the transportation of coin and currency had diminished as postal money orders came into more common use. And the use of money orders had made the U.S. mail much less lucrative for road agents. And not until Black Bart's stage robbery career had drawn to a close near the end of 1883, did anyone, including James Hume and other lawmen who had hunted him, realize he had committed at least 28 separate stage holdups. Only when Hume and Calaveras County Sheriff Ben Thorne questioned Bart at length and assured him of immunity from prosecution did they learn the full extent of his depredations against Wells Fargo. Hey, this is quite a story, I have to say. I'm Greg Schindel, a trained singer. We're on KLLG, riding on the Bipolar Express, and we're talking about our local bandit hero, Blackie Bart. You know, we knew he was telling the truth, they said, because he related details of each robbery. His memory was good, and he told us some of the fine points of the holdup, you know. But there's many things that he never did. He never did divulge. He never said where he got the wound, and he never said where he stayed. And, you know, he was a very careful guy, I gotta say. So, Black Bart, we are moving right along here. I would love to read this entire book to you, but I'm going to tell you, I'd be falling asleep before I even get to page 59, you might say. Oh, well. And, you know, from November 1882 until April 83, Black Bart refrained from any further robberies while presumably enjoying life in San Francisco. And although Jim Humes now possessed a good description of him, he had not been able to turn up another single clue as to his identity or whereabouts of this prime robbery suspect. Then, on April 12th, 1883, 5 miles from Cloverdale on the Lakeport Cloverdale Road, Black Bart robbed a stage driven by Bill Conebeck. The stage had no shotgun messenger, and Bart escaped unscathed with the meager contents of both the express box and mail sacks. Cloverdale Wells Fargo agent Charles Aul, in a message to Hume in San Francisco, said, "The robber, without a doubt, is Black Bart. The mail sacks are cut the same as all the robberies he has committed." And what stage driver Sam Smith had said concerning the paucity of valuables carried in the Wells Fargo Express boxes on the Sonora-Milton run also proved true at Cloverdale. Bart's take from both the express box and the mail bags amounted to something less than $50. Oh, boy, poor Blackie. June 23rd found Black Bart, excuse me, back in the mother lode, where in Amador County, 4 miles west of Jackson, he robbed a Jackson lone stage driver by Clint Radcliffe. Driven by Clint Radcliffe. Now, this time, Bart's take probably was considerable, for several mines in the Jackson-Sutter Creek area were still producing well and quite regularly shipped fairly large amount of gold. Well, in addition, Jackson was a busy foothill town, and the mailbags which Black Bart appropriated along with the Wells Fargo box probably contained considerable cash. Now, Bart escaped into the rolling oak and chemise brother-covered hills, leaving not a trace. Actually, he was only about 40 miles from Sacramento, and traveling back roads and trails, he could have made his way there fairly easily. Black Bart is, I just amazed what kind of a woodsman he was. You know, but Black Bart currently displayed, you know, he certainly displayed more intelligence and exercise greater caution than the run-of-the-mill stagecoach bandit that Wells Fargo was used to dealing with. You know, the very fact that his career of outlawry extended over a period of 8 years, that attests to that. And to Bart's favor, he never drank to excess, never bragged or spoke to anyone of his exploits, nor drew undue attention to himself. His guise was as successful. A mine owner provided him the perfect cover, for it allowed him to absent himself from the city for various periods of time without being questioned by friends. No. But Bart also was just plain lucky. You gotta say he was lucky, Mike. I mean, consider this. He had no bullets in his shotgun.
Just total bluffing it all the way.
Wow, it's kind of like you and me, huh? Right here at KLLG. We're bluffing our way through this thing. Well, I'm not. I'm reading. This guy might be bluffing, but no, I'm sorry. I got carried away. Greg, was that you? No, it was Train. I knew it. Train, back off. Okay. He's talking in a very high voice today, too. I know. Tight underwear. Hey, Bart was just lucky. You know, his entry into the profession of stage robbery could have ended in his first attempt had not stage owner John Olive, riding inside the stage that morning on Funk Hill, prevented the young Sonora miner from bringing his Navy Colt revolver into play. You know, with an unloaded shotgun in his hands, Bart would have been an easy target. But even if the Henry rifle, which he was said to be carrying over his shoulder on a sling, had been loaded, he would have little chance to use it. His career also might have well have ended in his second episode had not Mendocino County Sheriff J.R. Moore, as good a woodsman as Black Bart, and an excellent tracker. He remained on the elusive bandit's trail for a few miles. If he'd done so, the sheriff might well have come up on the sleeping bandit rolled up in his blanket, and thus ended the Black Bart saga before it really got started. Lucky guy. Bart, of course, was again unarmed except for the unloaded shotgun. Luck simply was with him that day. And although Black Bart made it a practice not to pick on stages that carried shotgun messengers riding the box beside the stage driver, he could easily have stopped a stage with a guard riding inside and have been taking a load of buckshot for his trouble. Whoa!
That'd be painful.
Ow, buckshot, that hurts. That'll blow your head off.
Yeah.
A little birdshot, like, yikes, ow, ow, take that out. Oh, well. Hey, I have to remind you, this is the BPE, which is the Bipolar Express, and we are on this hometown radio station called KLLG, way up here in the wilds of Willits, California. Well, it was, and we're talking about Black Bart, our local boulevardier bandito, yes. Oh, no, not bandito, it's bandit. It's French, right? Greg Shuck. It was barely sunup. Oh, this is a great story. And a chill breeze was rifling the surface of the Stanislaus River on the morning of November 3rd, 1883, when Reason McConnell halted his stage in front of the Reynolds Ferry Hotel. Inside the hotel, in the glow of the kerosene lamps, McConnell could see people moving about. He noted with satisfaction that the ferry was tied up on his side of the river. Oh, that would save him several minutes of valuable time. A door slammed and 19-year-old Jimmy Rollery, whose mother, Olivia Antonia Rollery, she ran the hotel, came clashing and dashing down the hotel stairs, with several letters in his hand. Oh, good morning, Mac, he said, he called, as he traded the letters for a bundle of mail for the hotel. Then, taking notice that the stage carried no passengers, young Rollery, he paused before starting the hill to operate the ferry. Mac, hey, Mac, can I catch a ride up to the top of the hill with you? That last storm must have started pushing the deer down from the high country. Now, Jim Baker, he stopped on his way to Sonora last evening and said he saw two big bucks up there on the flat above Yaki Gulch. Oh, I'd like to get a shot at one of them while we could use the meat. Well, sure. Glad to give you a ride, replied McConnell. Go drop off the mail and get your gun. Well, Jimmy ran back to the hotel and returned a moment later carrying a well-worn but serviceable 44 caliber Henry rifle. Ooh, that's a big gun, which he handed to McConnell before hurrying down to untie the ferry. Limping along behind Rollery came rheumatic old Henry Requa, hanger-on at the hotel, who would return the ferry to the hotel side of the river after the stage had crossed. The river crossing, at the low water time of year was the work of only a few moments. As the stagecoach pulled ashore, Jimmy Rollery also leaped from the raft, climbed up on the box beside McConnell, and retrieved his rifle. Reason E. McConnell, 31, had been a stage driver for the best part of 10 years. He had left the Nevada Stage Company Sonora's office in early morning darkness and today was traveling without a guard. And he was happy to have Rollery's company for the last part of the trip. And McConnell, he'd stopped at the Patterson Mine near Tuttlestown, where he had picked up 228 ounces, 19 pounds of amalgamated gold worth $4,200. The Wells Fargo strong box he carried also carried $500 in gold coin and $64 in raw gold. Boy, I need to cook that stuff up. Put it in my teeth. Oh, stop it. As a safety precaution, the box had been bolted to the stagecoach floor. With no passengers and a minimum of freight, the horses moved briskly from the river bottom up the steep, narrow road. For 45 minutes, they climbed steadily. Then, halfway up Funk Hill grade, Jimmy Rollery signaled McConnell to slow down. "I'll get off here, work my way around the hill," he told McConnell. "I might jump a buck out one of those draws up ahead and maybe get a shot at one of them up on the ridge where Baker saw those two the other day." "Well, so thanks, Mac, for the ride. I'll see you later." And with that, he jumped nimbly from the stage. "Oh, good luck," called the driver. "Save me a chunk of liver if you get me a big one." He waved at the boy, and he disappeared into the fringe of the roadside oaks. Their flanks heaving from exertion, the six-horse team continued up the grade for another 30 minutes. They were rounding the head of Yaki Gulch, the ridge top within sight, when suddenly the lead horses snorted. And they reared in fright. McConnell struggled to control them. And the hooded figure, shotgun in hand, leaped into the road in front of him. Why, there was no mistaking who it was or what his intent. He wore a dirt-smudged duster and the same flour sack with eye holes cut in it that every stage driver had either seen or heard about for the past 8 years. This was the same spot, exactly, where John Shine's stage had been robbed 8 years earlier on July 26, 1875. In fact, this bandit, McConnell realized, had been hiding behind the same boulder where the stage robber had concealed himself in 1875. Boy, you find a good place, you stick with it, right? Yeah. Well, with shotgun pointed squarely at McConnell's chest, the gunman, in a deep, authoritarian voice, told him to throw down the box.
"Throw down the box, please."
"I can't," replied the driver. "It's bolted to the floor of the stage."
"Well, then get off that stage and come down here and unhitch your horses," he was told.
Boy, Black Bart's voice has gotten deeper as the years go by. McConnell stalled for a time. And then the stage's brakes were bad, and he unhooked the horses and he said it would roll back down the hill if he did that. "Well, it won't roll if you put rocks behind the wheels," said the stage robber.
"Now climb off that stage and get some rocks."
Biting his tongue and praying he was not pushing the bandit too far, McConnell asked,
"Well, why don't you do it?"
Much to his surprise, the hooded man, keeping his shotgun trained on the driver, worked his way warily around the stage and then, holding the gun in one hand, picked up several large stones and blocked the wheels. With his patience clearly wearing thin, the gunman again ordered McConnell to the ground to unhitch the horses. And that time, McConnell, he hastily complied. No one could ever ever justly accuse Reason McConnell of not being a brave man, but he was not a damn fool. He was to marry Miss Rebecca Bunce, 18, of Milton, on August the 29th of the next year, and, well, that was a date he intended to keep in good health. So he gave the exasperated robber no further argument as he began leading the team of horses up the hill. Warned the gunman,
"And if you don't want to get shot, don't come back or even look back in this direction for at least 1 hour."
Well, the bandit wasted no time starting to work on that strongbox. And as he led his team up the road, McConnell heard the robber hammering and prying in the metal box. Several times he stole backward glances, but was unable to see the man who apparently had crawled completely into the stagecoach. But at the top of the hill, top of the ridge, some 200 yards above the stage, McConnell, who had been walking faster than he realized, stopped to catch his breath. The horses, immediately taking advantage of the pause, dropped their heads and began to nibble on the short blades of new grass the early fall rains had brought. Angry and still breathing hard, McConnell stood watching the horses, wondering what to do next, when a movement far down the hillside caught his eye. It was Jimmy Rollery, rifle in the crook of his arm, moving cautiously along an open swale of land, unaware what had transpired just moments earlier on the road above him. Jimmy was still deer hunting. Oh, my. Quickly, tying the team to a small oak tree, McConnell ran down the hill a short distance, where he could tame a better view of the boy, who was still in sight, some 300 yards before him. Afraid to shout, McConnell began to frantically wave his hat. Rollery moved on, traveling slowly, apparently watching the hillside in front of him and below him. Then, just when it seemed he would disappear without seeing McConnell, he turned, looked up the hill, and spotted the stage driver waving wildly at him. The boy paused. Then began to climb the hill rapidly as McConnell beckoned him. Within minutes, Rollery, breathing hard from his fast climb, was standing beside the stage driver. His first impression as he climbed the hill was that McConnell had seen a buck and he was summoning him to shoot it. Quickly, the stage driver explained the situation, and in a moment, he and the youth were moving rapidly but quietly down the hill toward the stage. Well, it was McConnell's intention to move up quickly to the stagecoach, catch the bandit unaware as he worked inside the opened metal box, and with Rollery's rifle, either take him prisoner or, if he resisted, kill him on the spot. But at least 100 yards still separated them from the stage when the bandit suddenly emerged from its open door and instantly caught sight of them. He turned, grabbed a sack which he slung over his shoulder, and began to run. McConnell, who was carrying the Henry rifle now, threw it to his shoulder and fired. But the bullet only kicked up dust behind the running man. Poof! He levered a second cartridge, fired, and missed again. "Here, give it to me. I won't miss Jimmy Rollery." Grabbed the rifle from McConnell's hands. He shot just as the fleeing man reached the brush line. And through the haze of black powder smoke, they saw the bandit stagger slightly as he disappeared. Running to where they had last seen him, McConnell and Rollery found a bundle of letters the stage robber had dropped when he entered the bushes. However, he apparently had managed to retain his grasp on the sack he was carrying. Several yards down the hill, they saw several more pieces of mail scattered on the ground, and when they picked them up, they found that some were spattered with fresh blood, confirming that Rollery's bullet had not missed. McConnell was confident that the robbery had been committed by the man who called himself Black Bart, the P-O-8, the poet. We're reading about our local bandito hero, Blackie Bart. So, this is KLLG, BPE, and I'm GS, TS, Hometown Radio. Hey, you know, exclaimed Rollery, as they stood there viewing the robbery scene, I'll swear that's the same man who stayed at our hotel one night last week. And later, when questioned by authorities, Olivia Rollery confirmed her son's remarks, vividly recalling the gray-haired man who can't come to the hotel a week or so before the robbery and inquired about stage schedules. Mrs. Rollery's description fit that of the stage robber, and although she had thought nothing of it at the time, the man had raised the suspicions of her daughters and old Henry Requa when he asked for a key to lock his room. Now, in those days, few people in the mother lode saw any reason to lock their doors. Well, people should still lock their doors, but, you know, at my house, the only time we lock our doors is when we're in there. So, anyway. Upon arriving at Copperopolis, Reason McConnell reported the holdup, and within the hour, an ad hoc posse of local citizens were galloping out of town. And before nightfall, Calaveras County Sheriff Ben Thorne had reached the robbery scene, and Wells Fargo Detective Chief James Hume, notified by telegraph, was on his way. And before leaving his office in San Andreas, Sheriff Thorne asked San Joaquin County Sheriff Tom Cunningham and Tuolumne County Sheriff George McQuaid to set up a watch for the fleeing bandito. And at the robbery site, despite earlier arrival of the volunteer posse men, who had managed to obliterate most of the tracks and visual evidence, Thorne found the stage robber had left behind wealth of clues. Below the road, the posse had picked up a size 7 1/4 black derby hat. And behind, a large rock on the uphill side of the road, where the bandit had hidden while waiting for the stage, but where the volunteer lawman had forgotten to look, Thorne found a travel-worn leather valise. In the traveling bag was a pair of field glasses, a belt, a razor, 3 soiled linen shirt cuffs, 2 paper sacks containing crackers and sugar, and 2 empty flour sacks. One of the flour sacks bore the label of Sperry Mills of Stockton, and the other one carried the name of a Sonora company. Now, the sheriff also found in the bag, an old handkerchief. Dun, 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 dun. His hanky. In which was knotted a handful of buckshot. Now, what the significance of the buckshot and the handkerchief was, Sheriff Thorne could not determine. But the shotgun, which the bandit known as Black Bart was used during the robberies, had always been described by his victims as a breech loader. And for what purpose the stage robber might be carrying those loose buckshot, Thorne was unable to fathom that. You know about guns. Yeah, what would you be carrying something like that for? Maybe he wanted to go fishing and he wanted even weights or something?
Or something, yeah.
Maybe he had a slingshot. You know, used to,
take the shot out and just leave the powder in?
Oh, who knows? You know, the sheriff also found in the bag. Oh, I read that. You know, the shotgun, he never shot that thing. He never blasted it. And whatever the purpose of the buckshot might have been, the importance of the shot itself quickly faded when the sheriff, back at his office the next day, untied the handkerchief containing the large lead pellets, and it was not the round gray pieces of a shot that tumbled onto his desk that caught his attention, but the handkerchief itself. There, in one corner of the soiled cloth, Sheriff Thorne made out fading lettering. It was not a name, and at first the scribbling seemed to make no sense. Then the sheriff realized that the letters and figures at which he was staring, F, period, X, period, O, period, 7, period, constituted, you got it, a laundry mark. Uh-oh. Later in that day, when Jim Hughes arrived from San Francisco, they retrieved the evidence found at the robbery scene. And Thorne turned over the handkerchief, hat, and other articles to Hume. And the next day, they talked to Mrs. J.C. Crawford, who had sold the bags of sugar and crackers found in the leather valise. Determine who had made the sale was one of the detective's easier tasks, for as her only means of advertising, Mrs. Crawford stamped the name of her Angel's Camp store on all her paper bags. The sale, she said, had been made the previous week. Mrs. Crawford's description of the purchaser fitted perfectly with that of the man known as Black Bart, and the description given by Mrs. Rollery. Now, the two law enforcement men took careful note of their increasing store of information, but they also learned that their quarry, at least for the present, had once again slipped through their fingers. The volunteer posse, which Thorne had directed to scour the surrounding hills for further clues, had ridden to the cabin of Trapper John P. Martin, about a mile from Frunk Hill. Martin told them that on the day of the robbery, a gray-haired man with a small beard had come to his cabin, and when asked where he was headed, said he was on his way to his home in Jackson. Well, the man, according to the trapper, said he had been visiting a friend in a Chinese camp. But he also had raised Martin's suspicion when, before leaving, he asked directions to Jackson and whether he would pass through Angel's Camp. And Martin said, after receiving directions on how to reach Jackson and avoid Angel Camp, had the visitor left. So they're kind of on to him here. Thorne learned that this was not simply a ploy used by the stage robber to throw off pursuers when a few days later he met up with Doc Silversteer, a local prospector who said that he met a man in the Bear Mountain Range south of Andreas who asked him how much further was it to Jackson, and Sylvester's description of the man matched the one given by Mrs. Crawford and the Rollerees. Now, how are we doing for time here? Because I want to make sure I can... we have some more time. This is so interesting to me. I really want to cover this today. And by the way, next week we'll start with some of that Greg Schindel train singer stuff. Jeez, that'll be weird. Well, what are we going to do? Okay, stop. So what are we doing here? Yes. Well, I'll tell you. Charles Bolton, as he preferred to be known, had arrived in the Motherlode on his ill-destined trip during the latter days of October, 1883. And in the foothills, October is one of the most pleasant times of years. The heat of the summer has abated, and winter's cold, rainy days are some weeks away yet. In normal years, the first fall rains have sprouted the grass, and the oaks are turning russet. Toyon berries were taking on their crimson hue, and in the deeper canyon's water, maples have become pillars of golden flame. Well, this is some nice writing, isn't it? Well, Bolton had stopped in Tuttletown, and again passing himself off as a visiting miner owner, talked with the superintendent at the Patterson Mine. With little difficulty, he obtained a good idea of its weekly production, and from others he learned when the gold shipments were made. He walked the Sonora Milton stage road from Tuttletown to the outskirts of Copperopolis. He also broke one of his almost ironclad rules about being seen in public near the site of a planned stage robbery. He stayed overnight in the Reynolds Ferry Hotel. So on October 30th, after considering several possible sites for his upcoming robbery of the Sonora Milton stage, he chose exactly the same spot he had used during his first robbery 8 years earlier. And on July 26, 1875, he established a sleeping camp high on Funk Hill above the stage road where he could observe the flow of traffic without being seen. His meager camp set up the shelter of a large rock outcropping consisted simply of a thick mat of dry grass over which he spread a blanket. And at times he built a tiny fire to boil coffee. The fire was kept small to avoid any telltale trace of smoke, and his only food was crackers and the sugar used in his coffee. In late evening he would walk nearly a mile to a spring to get water. Now, on the morning of November 3rd, Bolton moved down the hill in darkness to take up his post behind the same boulder he had used 8 years before. Now, it was an ideal spot for a holdup. The team of horses, after a long pull up the hill from the river, would be winded and traveling at a slow pace. In fact, almost in front of the rock behind which he was hidden, the road narrowed, going into an inside turn at the head of Yaki Gulch, forcing the horses to go even slower. Keeping watch down the hill, he was gratified to see that the stage carried no passengers. Passengers only complicated things, like that damn fool woman who flung her purse out to him. Say. And there was also always the possibility of some idiot on the stage deciding to become a hero, taking a shot at him. Well, the actual stopping of the stage had gone smoothly, at least at first, except for the momentary argument with the driver about putting a rock behind the wheel. The shotgun had properly intimidated him, and as the driver and horses started up the hill, Bolton had anticipated no further problem except for opening the iron Wells Fargo box bolted to the floor of the stage. That always was a tough nut to crack, but it always took too much time. While he was totally unaware of trouble, as he dropped the poke of an amalgam and the pouch of coins into his sack and prepared to step through the door of the coach. But even before his foot touched the ground, he saw movement from the corner of his eye, saw a man raising a rifle. He grabbed the sack and started to run. Uh-oh. It seemed like forever before he heard the first shot. He heard the second bullet whistle past his ear. He actually heard the sound of the shot. He was entering the brush and thought he was safe when he heard a thwack, like the sound of a windmill paddle breaking in a storm. There was a stinging in his hand, and the letters he had been holding scattered around his feet. Ow! Bolton looked down, saw blood dripping from the ends of his fingers, and dropped the other two and three letters still in his hand. Ow! He continued to run, carrying the sack containing his shotgun, the $550 in coins, and nearly 20 pounds of amalgam, dodging through the brush and trees for more than a quarter of a mile until exhaustion forced him to halt. Still breathing hard from his sprint, Bolden sacked to his knees. Oh, God. And gingerly inspected his wound to find that the heavy lead slug had cut a shallow groove across the back of his left hand. Although the bullet seemed to have little more than broken the skin and was causing little pain, the wound continued to bleed profusely. Now, to stem the flow of blood, he wrapped his handkerchief tightly around the injured hand and then continued his flight. Later, he told the resting officers, "I was so overcome at that time with surprise and fatigue that a 10-year-old could have captured me." But he kept going. He found a rotten log, stuffed the amalgam under it, and a few miles later, hid the shotgun in a hollow stump. And the only thing he kept was the $550 in gold coin. Hey, we're talking about that bad guy, our hero. No, he's not my hero, but he's a local mandito, Black Bart. And we're on KLLGLP 97.9 FM Willits, and this is the BPE. Whee! You know, traveling toward Bear Mountain, Bolton accidentally wandered into Martin's camp. He got directions and headed northwest, not toward Angel's Camp or San Reyes, but west of both communities. And he probably crossed what is now Highway 12, somewhere between San Andreas and Valley Springs. En route, he found another cabin from which he took a fairly respectable hat to replace his lost derby. By Monday night or Tuesday morning, he was in Sacramento, having covered some 80 miles of Central California's roughest foothill country in 3 days. Jeez, John Muir would have loved this guy. His hand, although sore, had not become infected and was bothering him only slightly. And he was more concerned about the appearance of his injury than the attention it might attract about the actual wound itself. And on Tuesday morning, he walked into the Sacramento barber shop for a shave and a haircut. And then from one of the town's better tailors, he ordered a suit of clothes. And that afternoon, he left for Reno on the eastbound train.
He spent the next 2 days or 3 days in Reno. And while there, he wrote to the owner of the Webb House at 37th Second Street in San Francisco, where he lived, to say that he would be back in the city shortly. He also wrote to Thomas Ware, his laundry agent, telling him to hold his laundry. Well, on November 9th, Charles Bolton rolled the Southern Pacific back to Sacramento, picked up his new suit, and the next day he returned to San Francisco. However, he did not immediately return to the Webb House. Instead, contacting no one, he spent the night in another hotel where he was not known. The following day, when it appeared there was no danger of having been followed or identified, he returned to the Webb House to once again enjoy the good life. Now notified on November 3rd of another Black Bart robbery, Wells Fargo Superintendent J.J. Valentine was livid. Angry with Calaveras and Tuolumne County stage companies and with his own people for not providing guards for treasure shipments, he threatened to place an embargo on his company's acceptance of gold shipments from those counties. The robbery of November 3rd, he noted, was the seventh Milton-bound stage to be robbed in 2 years. There had been 15 robberies of Milton stages in little more than 10 years, and the past 2 years had been the worst. If these robberies are not halted, he said, Wells Fargo will be forced to place an embargo on express service to Milton, as it has been forced to do so in the El Dorado, Placer counties, towns of Michigan Bluff, Forest Hill, Todd's Valley, Greenwood, and Cool in 1881. Jim Hughes returned to his San Francisco Wells Fargo office on the night of November 4th, and the next morning he spoke briefly with Superintendent Valentine, who seemed not overly impressed with the articles left by the fleeing bandit. Valentine was not interested in knick-knacks found at the robbery scene. He wanted the robber. Hume then turned the evidence, including the laundry mark handkerchief, over to Detective Harry Morse, whom he had hired 6 months early for the specific purpose of working on the Black Bart case. And Harry Morse was no ordinary law enforcement man. Oh, no. He had served as sheriff of Alameda County for 14 years, and during those years had built up an enviable record of crime fighting. So this is the guy. This is the one who actually is going to nail Blackie Barty. Let's see how far I can get here. We've got about 10 minutes left, and here we go. For 6 months, Harry Morse had met with nothing but frustration as he traveled the state seeking information that might reveal the identity or whereabouts of the bandit Black Bart. Now a smile of satisfaction lighted his face as James Hume laid derby hat, handkerchief, and other articles found at the Funk Hill robbery scene on his desk in front of him, and Morse's grin widened even more when he saw the laundry mark on the corner of the bedraggled handkerchief. "This," he told Hume, as he carefully inspected the bit of cloth with the India ink mark in the corner of it, "is the first solid clue we've come up since I've been here. It won't be an easy job, but something good is going to come of this." And Morse wasted no time. He had no idea where the handkerchief had been laundered, but since he was already in San Francisco, he decided that there is where he would start. A check of records of City Hall revealed 91 laundries in the city. It would slow, methodical work without any guarantee of success, but Morse knew that was mostly what good detective work was made of. And for a solid week, Morse wandered from laundry to laundry, from small hole-in-the-wall Chinese establishment to large company operations with several dozen employees. It was time-consuming work, and if nothing else, hard on shoe leather. Then, on November 12th, in Ferguson and Biggs, California Laundry at 113 Stevenson Street, the owners recognized the F period, X period, 0.7 as their laundry mark. Now, Phineas Ferguson sent Morse to the backer shop of one of the laundry company's agents, Tom C. Ware, at 316 Post Street. Tobacco shops of the 1800s, well, they not only sold tobacco, but served as a sort of, well, early-day convenience store, particularly for a masculine trade. Now, single men with bachelors, and bachelors who lived alone, you know. Hey, it was convenient to have and pick up a bundle of laundry when a man stopped to buy cigars or a pipe, you know, or chewing tobacco or opium or other minor items needed in his daily life. The laundry, in turn, sent a wagon there 3 days to pick up bags of dirty laundry and deliver the clean ones. But for tobacco shop prosperity, Thomas Ware, the operation of the laundry service ensured that his customers would come in regularly rather than randomly patronize the various tobacco shops in the area. And Ware's shop was conveniently located on Bush Street, only a short distance from the popular Buckley Saloon, and men coming home from work often stopped at the saloon for a drink, then swung by Ware's shop to pick up their clean laundry. Oh, my. We're getting to it. It was late afternoon when Morse arrived at Ware's shop and learned from its friendly owner that the laundry mart indeed belonged to one of his customers. He was Charles E. Bolton, a mining man and a friend of his, Ware told Morse. Mm-mm. The quick-thinking Morse introduced himself as Harry Hamilton and announced that he, too, was involved in mining and wished to meet Bolton. He said he had heard that Bolton left his laundry at Ware's shop and hoped through Ware a meeting could be arranged. Unsuspicious, Ware said he would be glad to oblige, and in fact Bolton, who had returned from his mine only a day or two ago, should be dropping in at any time to pick up his laundry. Bolton, he added, lived at the Webb House at 37 Second Street. Morse thanked Ware and said he would return. He took his leave and headed straight for the San Francisco police station. Captain Appleton Doublestone, friend of Morse and Hume, was glad to be back in the service to Wells Fargo and set up a stakeout for Bolton at the hotel. Morse then walked back to talk to the tobacconist, and at that time asked Ware if he could spare a few minutes to walk to the hotel and introduce him to Bolton. Ware agreed, and after locking his shop, started down the street with a detective. They hadn't gone less than a block when suddenly they met Charles Bowles face to face, heading for the tobacco shop. He spoke to me before I noticed him, Ware recalled. I introduced him to the man I knew as Hamilton. After they talked a few minutes, they turned and went back down the street, and I went back to my shop. I had no idea I'd been a party to the springing of a trap. Later, after he was criticized by some for turning stew pigeon, Ware wrote an angry letter to the local newspaper, excoriating Wells Fargo for using him in the capture of Charles Bolton, whom he learned, to his complete amazement, he was the bandit Black Bart. Well, when Morse met Charles Bowles, alias Charles E. Bolton, alias Black Bart, on Post Street, in the heart of cosmopolitan San Francisco, he had nothing of the appearance of a stage robber. Said Morse, he was elegantly dressed, carried a cane, wore a naughty little derby hat, a diamond pin and a large diamond on his little finger, and a heavy gold watch chain. Yet, beneath the finery was a man who fit almost exactly the description of the stage bandit which James Hune had put together from his many sources. This man was about 5 feet 8 inches tall, broad shoulders, high cheekbones, and a striking blue eyes. Kind of like you, Greg. Oh, was that? He carried himself with an almost military bearing, and his gray hair receding at the temples.
Kind of like you, Greg.
Hey, added to his appearance of gentle manly affluence, clean-shaven, except for a handsome gray mustache, and a small imperial beard. He looked for all the world like a prosperous businessman, and yet, at the same time, Morse was just as sure as he was standing there that he was staring at the man who had committed California's longest string of stage robberies. Wow-wee! Well, I've got to say, you know, it didn't come easily. They interrogated him. They brought in witnesses, and this went on for several days. But finally, his confession, it came out. It didn't come easily, but finally, seeing the situation closing in on him, Bart decided on the lesser of dangers facing him. He admitted to the Frank Hill robbery. And with Thorne and Stone, you know, with Stone in the cell, Bart stood up and said quite casually, "Well, let's go get it." And 30 minutes later, with Black Bart seated between them, Morse and Captain Stone were in the rented hack headed for Funk Hill, and it was a bright moonlit night, and although it was mid-November, it was not unduly cold. Perhaps it was his confession and the sudden lifting of the strain under which he had been for the past 3 days that loosened Bart's tongue. At any rate, he spared few details of his past several weeks' adventures, and then apparently in the belief in statutes of limitation he had expired, he recounted the details of his first robbery at the same site. Wow, they've got the guy now, and I have to say that he is ultimately convicted of just one robbery of all these. That's how he got away with this. Just one robbery. Well, you know, after serving only 4 years and 2 months of a 6-year sentence, Black Bart, he walked out of the San Quentin prison a free man on January 21, 1888. Now, the stage legislature, recent passage of the Goodwin Act, which allowed prison inmates time off for good behavior, he'd allowed prison officials to ease nearly one-third of his sentence. Bart had been a model prisoner, and he'd been helpful and willing in his work in the prison hospital, and apparently was quite appreciated. So I'm going to jump to the very back of this so we can finish this story. Oh, my gosh, it is 1:20. Woo! Where is it? It's the very end. Yes. Now, there's always, we don't know really what happened to Black Bart. But here's one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting. Just after daybreak, one warm day in the summer of 1888, a masked bandit, shotgun poised, stepped into the path of a six-horse stage as it headed down Geiger Grade on Virginia City, Reno Run. Now, whether the gunman had time to instruct the driver to throw down the box is academic. The driver did not drop the box, but nor did the messenger beside him drop his shotgun. Instead, twin loads of buckshot from the messenger's double-barreled 10-gauge, L.C. Smith, took the stage robber before his finger pulled the trigger of his own gun. The bandit was dead before he hit the ground. They didn't stand on ceremony in the Virginia area during the 80s. The stage, hardly pausing at the shooting scene, continued the 30-mile trip to Reno. And from that city, the Wells Fargo agent telegraphed Stoney County Sheriff John McCulloch at Virginia City to inform him of the attempted robbery and the bandit's death. Well, as time went on, it was a long time, so nobody really checked it out. So it's not sure what really did happen to him, whether the shotgun-toting bandit was the notorious Black Bart or some other luckless stage robber remains a matter of conjecture. But today, even the sight of the grave itself is lost. One point appears certain. Black Bart dropped from sight in 1888. Other than vague reports of perhaps self-serving hearsay, there's no really substantial evidence he was ever seen again. Did he, as many believe, return to the East, or did he lose himself in some small western or midwestern town, leading a sedentary life as a model citizen? Or, as it seems most likely, did he return to a life of banditry and now lie in some forgotten sandy Nevada grave? Wow. Black Bart. How much time do we have now? 2 minutes? Hey, this has been a wonderful opportunity to talk about our local legend, Black Bart, the Boulevardier Bandito. And I would like to close this show out. This is not a bank robber or a stage robber. This is a story about a card-playing killer. Next week, we're going to lighten up a little bit, aren't we, Greggy? Yes, we are. Wait, that sounded like train singer's voice. Okay. Now, this is a card player named Staggerly. Oh, and you got to be careful when you're playing a bandit. Hey! Now, Staggerly, Staggerly, the meanest man in town. You walk up to that bartender, lay your money down. Hey, you ever go down to New Orleans to the Lions Club? Every step you step, you step on all Billy D. Lion love. Staggerly and Billy D. Lies, two men again only. Staggerly drew 7, Billy swore he drew 8. Well, Staggerly said to Billy, hey boy, I can't let you go with that. You won all my money, And it's John B. Stetson. Staggerly went home, got his 44. Went back to that bar and he said, I'm gonna lay Billy on the floor. Oh, Staggerly, Staggerly, please don't take my life. I got 3 pretty children. Oh, you ought to see my wife. Nah, Staggerly shot Billy boy, shot the boy so bad. The bullet went through Billy and broke the bartender's glass. Hey, you ever go down to New Orleans? To the Lion's Club, every step you step, you're stepping on Billy D. Lion Blood. Well, here comes Mr. Staggerly, head way up high. 12 o'clock, they hang him, boy, glad to see him die. Whoa, great big mumbling underground, mama, what is that? Is that bad man Staggerly and his John B. Stetson hat? You know, Staggerly said to the devil, put your pitchfork on the shelf. I'm that bad man Staggerly, I'm gonna rule hell by myself. Oh, 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 Staggerly, Staggerly, meanest man in town. I walk up to that bartender and you lay your money down. Have a go down to New Orleans to the Lion's Club. Oh, every step you step, you stepping on Billy, hey, Billy D. Lion Blood. Bad men and bad characters. Well, so long, Black Bart. I hope, hey, now again, you can get all 3 of these shows by www.bigfig.com/BP Express. They are 93, 94, and 95. Hey, this is Greg Schindel, train singer. Saying goodbye and see you next week for on the Bipolar Express. Bipolar Express. In a KLLGLD. That is how the boy died. FM radio, radio, KLLGLP, 97.9. FM Willis, Willis, California, la, 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 la,